Chapter 33. It was not just the distraction of a wide-ranging Mueller investigation hanging over his head, but the constant media coverage that Trump had colluded with the Russians and/or obstructed justice, a real feeding frenzy, vicious, uncivil. The result, Porter said, in some moments it was almost incapacity of the president to be president. McMaster noticed it. Trump normally wouldn't listen long or very carefully to his national security advisor, but it had gotten much worse, McMaster told Porter. It's like I can't even get his attention. Don't take it personally, Porter advised. He's clearly distracted. He's been like that all day, because he's focused on this news about Russia. Gary Cohn told Porter, it's pointless to even talk to him today. Hope Hicks was worried. He's worked up about this, she told Porter. She wanted the president to settle down, avoid doing or saying anything rash or that he would later regret. She would try to get Trump to talk about other things, get his attention away from the television, even try to make light of things. They would get him on Air Force One to a rally. Leaving the plane for one rally, he said, I think I'm going to spend the first 10 minutes just attacking the media. On several occasions, Trump asked Porter if he was interested in being White House counsel. Porter declined. When Trump's personal attorney came to talk about matters relating to Special Counsel Mueller, Trump at times asked Porter to join in. Rob, I want you to stay. You've got to be a part of this. I'm not your lawyer, Porter said. I'm not acting as a lawyer, but even if I was, I'd be a government lawyer, not one of your personal lawyers, and that would break attorney-client privilege. And so, I can't be in here. No, Trump said. That doesn't matter. It would take one of Trump's personal lawyers like John Dowd saying, Rob needs to go. I don't know how much longer I can stay, Gary Cohn told Porter, because things are just crazy here. They're so chaotic. He's never going to change. It's pointless to prepare a meaningful, substantive briefing for the president that's organized where you have a bunch of slides, because you know he's never going to listen. We're never going to get through it. He's going to get through the first 10 minutes, and then he's going to want to start talking about some other topic. And so we're going to be there for an hour, but we're never going to get through this briefing. Porter tried to prepare organized briefing papers with relevant information, different viewpoints, costs/benefits, pros and cons, and consequences of a decision. It didn't work. Gary Cohn and Robert Lighthizer, the U.S. trade representative, had worked for months to get Trump to agree to authorize an intellectual property inquiry into China's trade practices. It was a case where Trump could flex his anti-trade muscle without blowing up a trade agreement. The authority came from Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974, which gave the president power to unilaterally institute punitive trade restrictions on countries that engage in unfair trading with the U.S. The Chinese broke every rule. They stole everything, from tech companies' trade secrets to pirated software, film, and music, and counterfeited luxury goods and pharmaceuticals. They bought parts of companies and stole the technology. They stole intellectual property from American companies that had been required to move their technology to China to operate there. Cohn considered the Chinese dirty, rotten scoundrels. The administration estimated China had committed $600 billion in intellectual property theft. A 301 investigation, 301 for short, would give Lighthizer 1 year to determine whether the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative should open a formal investigation of China. If so, Trump would have the authority to impose tariffs, sanctions, and other measures against China. The Europeans, Japanese, and Canadians would join the United States in a massive, coordinated effort against Chinese intellectual property violations. This would be the first trade enforcement by Trump. Trump had finally agreed to sign a memo and announce in a speech a year-long investigation of China's intellectual property violations. It had been a long march to provide him with clear, definable action on the trade front. During an August meeting in the residence with his economic and trade teams, Trump balked. He had just talked to President Xi. He didn't want to target China. "We're going to need their help for North Korea," he said. "It's not just one UN Security Council vote. We'll need their help on an ongoing basis. I want to take all the references to China out of the speech." He did not want to jeopardize his great relations with President Xi. Porter said the short two-page memo mentioned China five times, and only China. It was all about China, as they had been discussing for months. "No, no, no," Trump said. "I don't want to make it China-specific. Let's just do it for the whole world." Under the law, these investigations have to be about particular unfair trade practices by a specific country. "In this case, it's China," Porter said. "We can't get around the fact." "Well, okay," the president said. "I can sign whatever, but I don't want to mention China in the remarks." "We can't explain what this is without mentioning that we're targeting China." "Okay," Trump said. In his public remarks, he said, "The theft of intellectual property by foreign countries costs our nation millions of jobs and billions of dollars each and every year. For too long, this wealth has been drained from our country while Washington has done nothing. But Washington will turn a blind eye no longer." He made one mention of China. Cohn and Porter hoped signing the memo authorizing a 301 investigation would divert Trump from imposing steel and aluminum tariffs immediately. Whenever either of them would challenge Trump's conviction on the importance of trade deficits and the need to impose tariffs, Trump was immovable. "I know I'm right," he said. "If you disagree with me, you're wrong." Cohn knew the real battle was going to be over tariffs, where Trump had the most rigid views and where he could do the most damage to the U.S. and world economies. He shoveled all the data he could to the president about how tariffs on imported steel would be a disaster and hurt the economy. A 17-page document that Cohn sent contained a chart showing the minuscule revenue earned in 2002 to 2003 when President Bush had imposed steel tariffs for similar reasons. It showed that the revenue that came in was $650 million. That was 0.04% of the total federal revenue of $1.78 trillion. The estimated revenue from a 25% steel tariff would now be $3.4 billion, or 0.09% of expected total revenue of $3.7 trillion for 2018. Tens of thousands of U.S. jobs had been lost in industries that consumed steel, Cohn said, and produced a chart to prove it. Trump had three allies who agreed with him that trade deficits mattered: Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross, Peter Navarro, and Bob Lighthizer, the U.S. trade representative. Navarro said that the data did not include the jobs created in the steel mills under the Bush tariffs of 2002 to 2003. "You're right," Cohn said. "We created 6,000 jobs in steel mills." "Your data is just wrong," Navarro said. Trump was determined to impose steel tariffs. "Look," Trump said, "we'll try it. If it doesn't work, we'll undo it." "Mr. President," Cohn said, "that's not what you do with the U.S. economy." Because the stakes were so high, it was crucial to be conservative. "You do something when you're 100% certain it will work, and then you pray like hell that you were right. You don't do 50-50s with the U.S. economy." "If we're not right," Trump repeated, "we roll them back." NAFTA was another enduring Trump target. The president had said for months he wanted to leave NAFTA and renegotiate. "The only way to get a good deal is to blow up the old deal. When I blow it up, in that 6 months, they'll come running back to the table." His theory of negotiation was that to get to yes, you first had to say no. "Once you blow it up," Cohn replied, "it may be over. That's the most high-risk strategy. That either works or you go bankrupt." Cohn realized that Trump had gone bankrupt six times and seemed not to mind. Bankruptcy was just another business strategy. Walk away, threaten to blow up the deal. Real power is fear. Over the decades, Goldman Sachs had not done business with the Trump Organization or Trump himself, knowing that he might stiff anyone and everyone. He would just not pay or sue. Early in Cohn's time at Goldman, there had been a junior salesperson who did a bond trade for a casino with Trump. Cohn told the young trader that if the trade didn't settle, he would be fired. Fortunately for the trader, Trump did pay. Applying this mindset from his real estate days to governing and deciding to risk bankrupting the United States would be a different matter entirely. In another discussion with the president, Cohn unveiled a Commerce Department study showing the U.S. absolutely needed to trade with China. If you're the Chinese and you want to really just destroy us, just stop sending us antibiotics. You know, we don't really produce antibiotics in the United States. The study also showed that 9 major antibiotics were not produced in the United States, including penicillin. China sold 96.6% of all antibiotics used here. We don't produce penicillin. Trump looked at Cohn strangely. Sir, so when mother's babies are dying of strep throat, what are you going to say to them? Cohn asked Trump if he would tell them, trade deficits matter? We'll buy it from another country, Trump proposed. So now the Chinese are going to sell it, antibiotics, to the Germans, and the Germans are going to mark it up and sell it to us. So our trade deficit will go down with the Chinese, up with the Germans. U.S. consumers would be paying a markup. Is that good for our economy? Navarro said they would buy it through some country other than Germany. Same problem, Cohn said. You're just rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. The U.S. automobile industry was another Trump obsession. China was hurting the industry dramatically and U.S. workers even more, he alleged. Cohn assembled the best statistics that could be compiled. Trump would not read, so Cohn brought charts to the Oval Office. The numbers showed that the American auto industry was fine. One big chart showed Detroit's Big Three were producing 3.6 million fewer cars and light trucks since 1994, but the rest of the U.S., mostly in the Southeast, was up the same 3.6 million. The entire BMW 3 Series in the world were made in South Carolina, Cohn said. The Mercedes SUVs were all made in the United States. The millions of auto jobs lost in Detroit had moved to South Carolina and North Carolina because of right-to-work laws. What about the empty factories? Trump asked. We've got to fix this. Cohn had put another document, U.S. Record in WTO Disputes, in the daily book that Porter compiled for the president at night. But Trump rarely, if ever, cracked it open. The World Trade Organization is the worst organization ever created, Trump said. We lose more cases than anything. This is in your book, sir, Cohn said, and brought out another copy. The document showed that the United States won 85.7% of its WTO cases, more than average. The United States has won trade disputes against China on unfair extra duties on U.S. poultry, steel and autos, as well as unfair export restraints on raw materials and rare earth materials. The United States has also used the dispute settlements system to force China to drop subsidies in numerous sectors. This is bullshit, Trump replied. This is wrong. This is not wrong. This is data from the United States Trade Representative. Call Lighthizer and see if he agrees. I'm not calling Lighthizer, Trump said. Well, Cohn said, I'll call Lighthizer. This is the factual data. There's no one that's going to disagree with this data. Then he added, data is data. Cohn occasionally sought Vice President Pence's help, always in private conversations. He made his case on steel and aluminum tariffs. Mike, I need your help on this. You're doing the right thing, Pence said. I'm just not sure what I can do. Mike, there's no state going to be hurt worse than Indiana on steel and aluminum tariffs. Elkhart, Indiana is the boat and RV capital of the world. What goes into boats and RVs? Aluminum and steel. Your state is going to get killed on this.
Yeah, I got it.
Can you help me?
Doing everything I can.
As usual, Pence was staying out of the way. He didn't want to be tweeted about or called an idiot. If he were advising Pence, Cohn would have had him do exactly that. Stay out of it. Kelly concluded that Peter Navarro was the problem. Navarro would get into the Oval Office and spin Trump up on the trade deficits. Since he was preaching to the converted, Trump would soon be in full activist mode, declaring, "I will sign today." Cohn took every chance he could get to tell Kelly how Navarro was an absolute disaster. "Get rid of him," Cohn argued. "Fire him. This place is never going to work as long as he is around." Kelly asked Porter for his opinion.
"The current status quo is unsustainable," Porter said. "I don't think you can get rid of Peter because the president loves him. He'd never allow for that."
"You can't promote Navarro like he wants because that would be absurd."
"Peter needs to be responsible to someone other than feeling like he's got a direct report to the president. A lot of times I'm able to block him."
Kelly decided he was going to assert control and called a meeting of the combatants for September 26th. It was like a duel. Navarro was allowed to bring in a second, and he chose Stephen Miller. Cohn brought Porter. Navarro started off arguing that during the campaign, he was promised to be an assistant to the president. Now he was only a deputy assistant. "This is a betrayal." He said he couldn't believe it had lasted this long. He had talked to the president, who did not really know the difference between an assistant to the president and a deputy assistant. The president thought special assistant sounded a lot better, not realizing it was an even lower position. Navarro said that the president had told him he could have whatever title and reporting structure he wanted. He and his trade council represented the American worker, the manufacturing base, the forgotten man.
"Peter's out there going rogue," Cohn responded. "He's creating these problems. He's telling the president lies. He's totally unchecked. He's the source of all the chaos in this building."
"Gary doesn't know what he is talking about," Navarro replied. "Gary's just a globalist. He's not loyal to the president."
And Porter was always fiddling with the process and manipulating to delay everything so Navarro couldn't get in to see the president.
"All right," Kelly said. "I can't deal with this anymore. Peter, you are going to be a member of the National Economic Council and you're going to report to Gary. And that's just how it's going to be. And if you don't like it, you can quit. Meeting over."
"I want to appeal this," Navarro said. "I want to talk to the president."
"You are not talking to the president," Kelly said. "Get out of my office."
Months went by.
"Where the hell is my Peter?" the president asked one day. "I haven't talked to Peter Navarro in 2 months."
But as was often the case, he did not follow up. Chapter 34. Trump's face-off with Kim Jong-un was growing increasingly personal. On Air Force One, when tensions were ramping up, Trump said, in a rare moment of reflection, "This guy's crazy. I really hope this doesn't end up going to a bad place." He delivered contradictory comments on North Korea, from provocative and bombastic to assertions that he wanted peace. In May, he said he would be honored to meet with Kim under the right circumstances. In August, he told the press, "North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen." With no resolution, McMaster issued a new strategy outlining a North Korea pressure campaign. The plan, put forward in a signed document, was designed to pressure North Korea and China to negotiate the North's nuclear weapons program and cease development of their ICBMs. Treasury would work on sanctions. State would work on engagement with China to pressure the North. The Defense Department was to make military incursions such as overflights, going into their airspace in exercises called Blue Lightning,
and engage in limited cyber activity to demonstrate capability and show the threat. But these actions were not to trigger an unintended conflict. McMaster kept repeating in the NSC that Trump could not accept a nuclear North Korea. But the president summed up his position on almost everything in an interview with the New York Times. "I'm always moving. I'm moving in both directions." Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Dunford formed a strategic communications cell in his operations directorate, J3, to look at the messaging opportunities in North Korea. What actions could be taken that were just threatening enough to be a deterrent? When there were three aircraft carriers in the vicinity, Mattis voiced discomfort. Could this trigger an unanticipated response from Kim? Could the United States start the war they were trying to avoid? He showed more concern about this than many others in the Pentagon and certainly in the White House. Mattis was a student of historian Barbara Tuchman's book, The Guns of August, about the outbreak of World War I. "He's obsessed with August 1914, one official said, and the idea that you take actions, military actions, that are seen as prudent planning, and the unintended consequences are you can't get off the war train. A momentum to war builds, and you just can't stop it." Mattis did not want war. The status quo and a no-war strategy, even amid powerful, overwhelming tensions, were a win-win. The official summed it up. Mattis and Dunford's view is that North Korea can be contained. Dunford actually said, "This was my advice to the president." On September 19, 2017, President Trump gave his first address to the United Nations General Assembly. For the first time, he dubbed the North Korean leader Rocket Man. He said the United States, if forced to defend itself, will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Kim fired back 3 days later. A frightened dog barks louder, and said Trump is surely a rogue and a gangster fond of playing with fire. "I will surely and definitely tame the mentally deranged U.S. dotard." In a tweet on September 23rd, Trump called Kim Little Rocket Man. Trump and Rob Porter were together in the president's front cabin on Air Force One. Fox News was on the TV. "Little Rocket Man," Trump said proudly. "I think that may be my best ever. Best nickname ever." "It is funny," Porter said, "and it certainly seems to have gotten under Kim's skin. But," he asked, "what's the end game here? If we continue to amp up the rhetoric and get into a war of words and it escalates, what are you hoping to get out of this? How does this end?" "You can never show weakness," Trump replied. "You've got to project strength. Kim and others need to be convinced that I'm prepared to do anything to back up our interests." "Yes, you want to keep him on his toes," Porter said. "And you want some air of unpredictability from you, but he seems pretty unpredictable. And we're not sure, is he even well? Is he all mentally there? He doesn't have the same political constraints that other people do. He seems very much to want to be taken seriously on the international stage." "You've got to show strength," the president repeated. "I wonder," Porter plowed on, "if embarrassing him is more likely to sort of get him into submission, or if it could also provoke him." Trump didn't respond. His body language suggested that he knew Kim was capable of anything. Then he offered his conclusion. "It was a contest of wills. This is all about leader versus leader. Man versus man, me versus Kim." At the end of September, General Kelly asked Graham to come to the White House for an upcoming tabletop exercise on North Korea. Contradictory messages from Trump and Tillerson were flooding the news. For weeks, Tillerson had been out publicly with what he called the four no's. The United States was not seeking regime change or a collapse of the regime, was not looking for an accelerated reunification of the North and South, and did not want an excuse to send troops into the North. "We've got the guy guessing,"
Kelly said to Graham, referring to Kim Jong-un. Graham made a dramatic proposal to Kelly and McMaster. China needs to kill him and replace him with a North Korean general they control, Graham said. China had at least enough control so the North would not attack. I think the Chinese are clearly the key here, and they need to take him out, not us, them, and control the nuclear inventory there, and wind this thing down, or control him, to stop the march to a big nuclear arsenal. My fear is that he will sell it. He proposed that Trump tell China, "The world is a dangerous place. I am not going to let this regime threaten our homeland with a nuclear weapon." Graham said Trump had told him he would not let this happen. He had done everything but take an ad out in the newspaper telling the world what Trump had told him to his face. On October 1st, months after Tillerson had begun publicly reaching out to North Korea to open a dialogue, Trump tweeted, "I told Rex Tillerson, our wonderful Secretary of State, that he is wasting his time trying to negotiate with Little Rocket Man. Save your energy, Rex. We'll do what has to be done." The bellicose tweet was widely interpreted as undermining the nation's top diplomat. Trump had apparently been seized by an impulse. During the presidential campaign, Trump himself had extended an olive branch, voicing a willingness to negotiate with Kim over a hamburger. But overlooked was that Trump had a way of appearing to strengthen his own hand by creating a situation, often risky, that did not previously exist. Threatening the volatile North Korean regime with nuclear weapons was unthinkable, but he had done it. It turned out to be only the beginning. The go-along, get-along presidency of the past was over. Trump was soon tugging harder on Kelly's leash, and after several months, the Kelly mystique of controlling Trump faded. It was clear that Trump didn't like outsider control emotionally, as if to say, "I can't deal with this anymore. I feel cocooned. I feel I'm no longer in charge." In November, Trump saw Chris Crane, the head of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, union, complaining on Fox News about access to Trump. He said Trump was letting them down. The union had endorsed Trump 6 weeks before the election, the first time the National ICE Council, as it was called, had endorsed a presidential candidate. Trump went through the roof. Kelly and Chris Crane had an intense dislike for each other. When Kelly had been Secretary of Homeland Security, he had blocked ICE agents from a hardline crackdown on some immigration violations. Trump invited Crane to the Oval Office without informing Kelly. "Kelly's cut off all our access," Crane said. "We put ourselves on the line for you. We endorsed you. We support all your policies. Now we can't even communicate with you." Kelly heard Crane was in the Oval Office and strode in. Soon, Crane and Kelly were cursing each other. "I can't believe you'd let some fucking guy like this into the Oval Office," Kelly told Trump. "If this was the way it was going to work," he said, "then I quit." And he stormed out. Trump later told others that he thought Kelly and Crane were going to get into a fistfight. Kelly urged the president to select Kirstjen Nielsen, a 45-year-old lawyer who had been Kelly's Department of Homeland Security deputy, as the new secretary. "Kirstjen is the only person who can do this," Kelly argued to the president. "She knows DHS. She was my chief of staff. She's terrific at all this stuff." The nomination was sent to the Senate on October 11th. The president saw that Fox News commentator Ann Coulter called Nielsen an open borders zealot who opposed Trump's border wall. Lou Dobbs piled on, saying Nielsen was pro-amnesty, not a true believer, not an immigration hardliner, and served in the George W. Bush administration. At her confirmation hearing, she had said, "There is no need for a wall from sea to shining sea," and Dobbs, a strong Trump supporter, called this comment outrageous. "Everybody's saying that she's terrible," Trump said later to Kelly in the Oval Office. "It's a joke. She's a bushy. Everybody hates her. How could you have possibly made me do this?"
She's the best, Kelly said. She's the best of the best. I can personally vouch for her. She's the first woman to lead the department. I know she's a good person. She's doing a great job. She will be very effective. She is on your team. She was my right-hand person when I was there. She knows the department. That's all bullshit, Trump said. She's terrible. You're the only one that thinks she's any good. Maybe we'll have to withdraw her nomination. Kelly threw up his hands. Maybe I'm just going to have to resign. And he stormed out. Porter later took Nielsen's commission for Trump to sign that would officially make her secretary. I don't know if I really want to sign this right now, Trump said. I'm just not sure about her. She's been confirmed, Porter said. The Senate had approved her nomination 62-37. You're going to attend her swearing in. Trump signed. Kelly appeared on Fox News' Bret Baier show and said that Trump had gone through an evolutionary process and changed his attitude toward the DACA issue and even the wall. At the White House, Trump went through the roof. Did you see what Kelly said? He asked Porter. I evolved? I've changed on this? Who the fuck does he think he is? I haven't changed one bit. I am exactly where I was. We're going to build the wall. We're going to build it across the entire border. Zach Fuentes, Kelly's assistant, warned the senior staff in the West Wing that Kelly had a short attention span and was easily distracted. He's not a detail guy, said Fuentes, who had also been Kelly's assistant at Homeland Security. Never put more than one page in front of him. Even if he'll glance at it, he's not going to read the whole thing. Make sure you underline or put in bold the main points. However, there were some subjects, particularly about the military, Fuentes said, that would engage Kelly's full attention and he might want to have a long conversation. Normally, Fuentes said, you'll have 30 seconds to talk to him. If you haven't grabbed his attention, he won't focus. Kelly held regular senior staff meetings of the 20 top people from the White House every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday in the Roosevelt Room. He frequently reviewed his conversations with the president. I talked with the president over the weekend, Kelly recounted at one meeting. He's really hot on us getting out of the North Korean peninsula altogether, forcing the South Koreans to pay for THAAD. I've just been going back and forth with him, and I've really laid into him and told him he couldn't do this. As Kelly himself got caught in the Washington political crossfire and was criticized in the media, he spoke more and more about the press and his own role at the senior staff meetings. I'm the only thing protecting the president from the press, Kelly said at one meeting. The press is out to get him. They want to destroy him. And I'm determined to stand in the way, taking the bullets and taking the arrows. Everyone's out to get us. The press hates him. They hate us. They're never going to give us a break on anything. It's active hostilities. And so that's why we're taking all this incoming. They're also turning on me because I'm the one guy standing in front of the president trying to protect him. In a small group meeting in his office one day, Kelly said of the president, he's an idiot. It's pointless to try to convince him of anything. He's gone off the rails. We're in crazy town. I don't even know why any of us are here. This is the worst job I've ever had. Kelly began to have less control, less involvement. Trump called members of Congress when Kelly wasn't around. He called Chuck Schumer, Tom Cotton, Lindsey Graham, Dick Durbin, or cabinet members, underscoring that he was his own chief of staff and his own legislative affairs director. Madeline, he would call out, get Speaker Ryan on the phone. Trump's questions started. How's Kelly doing? He asked Porter. He's tough, but it kind of seems like he's too tough. I don't know that the staff really likes him that much. I think he's helped, Porter answered. Better to be feared than loved. But he's got his limitations. I think he just needs to recognize them. And you do too. Porter said he thought Kelly's weakness was on legislative matters. You really need a good political affairs director because that's not Kelly's background. And if you want your chief of staff to be your chief political advisor, it shouldn't be Kelly. Tillerson complained to Kelly many times about Porter getting Trump to sign decision memos without a sign-off from the Secretary of State. I know you've been trying to loop Rex in, Kelly told Porter, but now you cannot take a decision memo to the president. You can't brief the president on something like that unless you have explicit sign-off. Kelly made clear that feedback from State in general or from Tillerson's chief of staff would not be sufficient. No decisions, Kelly instructed, until you've talked or emailed with Rex specifically. Trump heard about the conflicts. He liked aggressive disagreements. They smoked out a wide variety of opinions. Harmony could lead to groupthink. He embraced the chaos and churn beneath him. At about 9 p.m. Monday, November 27th, more than 4 months after Priebus left the White House, the president reached him on his cell phone. They talked for 10 minutes. What about the upcoming Senate race in Alabama? Trump asked. How was the ocean cruise that Priebus had just been on? Trump said it was amazing how much they got done together in the first 6 months. What about tax reform? And the Republican senators who were holding out on tax reform? Trump said that the stories the New York Times had that week were nuts. How do you think Rex is doing? Trump asked. You think he gets it? Priebus was careful. He thought Tillerson should have been great, but he was hard with the president, and the president didn't like hard. But the call was not heavy, as if Trump wanted someone to shoot the shit with. Kelly was all business. Kelly would not sit and BS. The president invited Priebus to lunch at the White House for Tuesday, December 19th. Now, as a private attorney, his proximity to the president and his well-publicized meetings were useful with his private clients. The world knew Priebus was still a player for sure. However, the president's questions about Tillerson reminded Priebus of all the times he learned that Trump had sounded out others about him. How do you think Reince is doing? It was a bad memory. Trump was always asking everyone their opinions of everyone else, seeking a report card. It was corrosive and could become self-fulfilling, undermining and eating at the reputations and status of anyone and everyone. The president's M.O. is to put people back on their heels, Priebus said. Put all the chips on the table, and then slowly but surely pick off each chip individually. It could be a person, a policy, a country, a foreign leader, a Republican, a Democrat, a controversy, an investigation. Trump would try to leverage anyone by any means, and at times he would succeed. He uses leverage in a way I've never seen before. Chapter 35. Now that he had agreed to stay to do tax reform, Gary Cohn had to deliver. The current U.S. corporate tax rate was 35%, one of the highest in the world. Reducing it had been a rallying point for Republicans and business people for years. It was all Trump had wanted to talk about at first. During the Bush and Obama years, dozens of large companies had moved their headquarters overseas to take advantage of lower foreign tax rates. This process was known as inversion, because it typically entailed creating a new parent company in a low-tax country like Ireland and making the existing American company its subsidiary. This was a big issue with Trump's business friends. Lowering the corporate tax rate could bring trillions of dollars back to the United States. The corporate rate's got to be 15%, Trump said. Sir, Cohn said, we'll try and get that. Treasury Department calculations showed very few corporations paid the full 35% because of various loopholes and special tax breaks that Congress had passed. Cohn agreed that the U.S. was out of sync with the rest of the world. Some countries like Ireland had a corporate tax rate as low as 9%. So bring the money back home, Cohn agreed. Trillions of dollars are parked offshore to avoid U.S. higher tax rates. About $4 trillion, Trump said. Even more, possibly $5 trillion. Cohn had a chart that showed it was $2.6 trillion. At one point, the president proposed raising the top income tax rates, currently 39.6% at the highest bracket, for earners in exchange for drastically lowering the corporate rate. "I'll take the personal top rate to 44% if I can get the corporate rate to 15%, Trump said. Cohn knew that was crazy, though he realized Trump, with all his real estate and other deductions, had probably never or rarely paid the full 39.6%. "Sir," Cohn continued, "you can't take the top rate up. You just can't." "What do you mean?" "You're a Republican," explained Cohn, who was a Democrat. "Republicans were always for lower personal income tax rates. Republicans were the party of Reagan, who had lowered the top federal income tax rate from 70% to 28%. You will get absolutely destroyed if you take the top rate up." Trump seemed to understand. Cohn had a packet of Goldman Sachs-style charts and tables to educate the president on taxes. Trump was not interested and did not read it. At a meeting in the Oval Office, Trump wanted to know what the new individual income tax rates would be. "I like these big round numbers," he said. 10%, 20%, 25%. Good solid numbers that would be easy to sell. Mnuchin, Cohn, and Office of Management and Budget Director Mick Mulvaney said there needed to be analysis, study, and discussion on the impact on revenue, the deficit, and the relation to expected federal spending. "I want to know what the numbers are going to be," Trump said, throwing out numbers again. "I think they ought to be 10, 20, and 25. He dismissed any effort to crunch the numbers. A small change in rates could have a surprising impact on taxes collected by the U.S. Treasury. "I don't care about any of that," Trump said. Solid, round numbers were key. "That's what people can understand," he said. "That's how I'm going to sell it." The central feature of Cohn's tax reform packet was on the first page. Increasing economic growth from 2% to 3% would create $3 trillion in budget savings over 10 years. "Sir, if we can get from 2 to 3%, that's all we've got to do. We could pay for the tax plan," Cohn said. The more economic growth, the more taxes the government would collect. Simple in theory, but it would be hard, perhaps impossible, to get 3% growth, often a Republican fantasy. Trump liked the idea. He was infatuated with the simplicity and started using variations of high economic growth in speeches. Cohn tried to explain that during the Reagan era, the U.S. economy had been very competitive, and other countries had begun cutting their taxes. There was plenty of history and technical detail. "I don't give a shit about that," Trump said. On Monday nights, Speaker Paul Ryan hosted an Italian buffet in his conference room for the six main tax reform players representing Congress and the administration. Known as the Big Six, they were Ryan, McConnell, House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Kevin Brady, Chairman of the Senate Finance Committee Orrin Hatch, Mnuchin, and Cohn. The group was a Democrat's nightmare. Five conservative Republicans and the former president of Goldman Sachs revising the tax code. The group came up with four principles: simplification of the tax code, tax relief for middle-income families, job creation and wage growth, and bringing back and taxing the trillions of corporate dollars stashed overseas. Cohn's approach to the congressional leadership was to treat them like gold. In his decades in the client service business at Goldman, everyone was treated as the most important client. He had told his clients there, "I'm available 24/7. You want to talk? We talk." The customer was always first, and only the customer counted. Now the congressional leadership was, for the moment, the only customer. Mnuchin had alienated some Republican House members early on in the administration by insisting they had to vote for certain continuing budget resolutions and for the debt ceiling, the limit on how much the government could borrow. OMB Director Mick Mulvaney, who had served 6 years in the House, reported to Cohn that one Republican told Mnuchin, "Mr. Secretary, the last time someone told me what I had to do, I was 18. It was my dad, and I never listened to him again either." Later, Mnuchin proposed capping the amount of business income a taxpayer could pay at the lower personal income tax rates, known as pass-throughs. He said some 95% of the pass-through tax returns were below $350,000 in annual income. "No," Ryan and Brady said. That was the dumbest idea they had ever heard. Mnuchin had not accounted for the other 5% of pass-through tax returns, which included huge mega-donors to the Republican Party like the Koch brothers. Mnuchin went behind Ryan's and Brady's backs to try to enlist some House Republicans. Mulvaney threw a note on Cohn's desk. "If you want to get tax reform done, keep Mnuchin out of the Capitol." Cohn reported this to Kelly. As the tax negotiations intensified in November, Mnuchin went on a tour of the country, speaking and selling the tax plan alongside Ivanka in California on November 5th and 6th, and New Jersey on November 13th, and on his own in Ohio on November 14th. On the Senate side, Finance Committee Chair Orrin Hatch put together a group made up of Senators Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, Rob Portman of Ohio, Tim Scott of South Carolina, and John Thune of South Dakota to handle the negotiations on his behalf, since he had a relatively limited knowledge of tax policy. Cohn was on the phone nonstop with these senators. Cohn discovered how challenging tax reform could be. One of his charts was titled, "The Federal Income Tax System is Very Progressive." He believed it was another important chart. It showed the big picture, told the whole story. 44% of Americans did not pay federal income tax. During the 2012 presidential campaign, when the percentage was higher immediately following the Great Recession, Republican nominee Mitt Romney was recorded saying disparagingly, "There are 47% who are with President Barack Obama, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they are victims, who believe the government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they are entitled to health care, to food, to housing, to you name it, that that's an entitlement, and the government should give it to them, and they will vote for this president no matter what. These are people who pay no income tax. My job is not to worry about those people. I'll never convince them they should take personal responsibility and care for their lives." While most of the 44% paid payroll taxes on their wages that went toward Social Security and Medicare, as well as state, local, property, and sales taxes, they paid $0 in federal income tax. That meant the federal government brought in revenue from its budget from only 56%. Many low-income people paid less than zero, Cohn's slide showed. Their income was so low that not only did they owe the government no federal income tax, they cost the federal government revenue because it gave them refundable tax credits, money from the government like the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit. Ivanka Trump worked with Senators Marco Rubio and Mike Lee to increase the child tax credit from up to $1,000 per child to $2,000. Rubio and Lee would not vote for the final tax package unless this was included. "We had to buy their votes," Cohn said. "We'd been extorted by Lee and Rubio." He believed the federal government had conflated taxes and welfare and, of course, was using tax legislation to help the poor. The corporate tax rate was still a key question. Trump was stuck on 15%. Cohn and Mnuchin finally got him to agree to 18%. Then Speaker Ryan, the tax expert, called and urged Trump to move to 20%. Orrin Hatch's group of senators and Cohn came up with a rate of 21%. Cohn called Trump. He gave the president a complicated technical description of the advantages of this corporate tax rate. A tax lawyer might understand the nuances of the various percentages or of certain loopholes. Trump could not possibly understand or care about it.
"Go for it," Trump said.
Cohn saw that he could do anything on the tax reform bill as long as Trump could call it a win. Trump had a marketing idea. Call it the Cut, Cut, Cut Bill. He loved the idea and had a long phone call with Ryan and Brady to sell this name. After the phone call, Trump was under the impression that it would be called the Cut, Cut, Cut Bill in the House. The House called it the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. But because of ancient Senate rules, that title was too short, and rather unbelievably, it was finalized as an act to provide for reconciliation pursuant to Titles 2 and 5 of the concurrent resolution on the budget for fiscal year 2018. Cohn found out that getting votes in the Senate was all about giving individual senators their favorite loopholes or tax breaks. "It's a candy store," he said. Senators Chuck Grassley, John Thune, and Dean Heller were among those who wanted credits for alternative fuel, including windmills. Susan Collins insisted on a deduction for school teachers who bought supplies for their classrooms. She would not vote for the bill if the deduction was not included. Ron Johnson of Wisconsin was concerned about pass-through businesses. McConnell made other promises, including one to Jeff Flake on immigration. The final bill was a dizzying labyrinth of numbers, rules, and categories. There was no doubt that it was a Republican tax bill, benefiting corporations and the wealthy most. The bill, however, would reduce taxes for all income groups in 2018, and according to the Tax Policy Center, after-tax income would go up an average of 2.2%. Most in the middle class, Americans earning taxable income ranging from $19,000 to $77,000, would go from the 15% tax bracket to the new lower 12% tax bracket, saving the average person hundreds of dollars. These individual tax cuts, however, would decrease each year and end altogether in 2025. The business benefits included the reduction in the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%. Another was that so-called pass-through enterprises such as partnerships and small businesses like the Trump Organization could get an effective 20% tax deduction. Around 1 a.m. on December 20, 2017, Vice President Pence was in the chair if they needed his vote to break a tie in the Senate. It passed 51-48. A senior Democratic senator with whom Cohn was good friends came up to him. He seemed to be the most agitated person walking off the Senate floor. "This will do damage for the next decade," the senator said. "We'll be undoing this for the next decade." Cohn urged him to relax. "We had to get competitive in the corporate world," he said. "We just had to. And when you see that chart of our competitors, look, we're in a competitive world." The individual income tax rates were pegged at 10, 12, 22, 24, 32, 35, and the top rate, 37%. The drop from 39.6% was standard Republican tax cutting. In the end, the law would add an estimated $1.5 trillion to the annual deficit over 10 years. Republican leaders and Trump celebrated with self-congratulatory speeches on the south portico of the White House. Trump said, "Ultimately, what does it mean? It means jobs, jobs, jobs." Tax reform was the only major legislation passed his first year. Chapter 36. Early in 2018, the president unleashed a full takedown of Bannon, who had clearly spoken to journalist Michael Wolff as a main source for his unflattering book, Fire and Fury. In a long statement rather than a tweet, Trump said,
Steve Bannon has nothing to do with me or my presidency. When he was fired, he not only lost his job, he lost his mind. Now that he is on his own, Steve is learning that winning isn't as easy as I make it look. From his point of view, Bannon believed Trump had largely failed as a change agent. The old order in national security certainly won in Trump's first year, Bannon believed. Perhaps the only exception was a toughening stance on China and an awareness that China was the true rival in international affairs. Bannon was appalled by the national security strategy, a 55-page document published in December 2017. The Middle East section said the policy was designed to preserve a favorable regional balance of power. "What the fuck is that?" Bannon asked. It was a retread of the old-world Kissinger-esque order, seeking political stability. The whole purpose of Trump's 2017 Riyadh summit had been to form an alliance to shut down Iranian expansion and hegemony. Balance of power, in Bannon's view, meant the U.S. was comfortable with the status quo and Iran's short-of-war strategy that took confrontation to the brink, but left Iran owning the gray zone. Bannon believed that Trump wanted to roll Iran back, get Iran out of Iraq, out of Syria, out of Lebanon, and out of the peninsula in Yemen. The alliance to do that was the U.S., Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, and Israel. China was the real enemy. Russia was not the problem. The Russian economy was the size of New York State's economy, about $1.5 trillion, and the Chinese economy would soon be bigger than that of the United States, perhaps within a decade. Bannon still believed the forces of the populist nationalist movement were powerful, but the old order was able to blunt all that in the first year of the Trump presidency. The old order was not going to roll over. The populist movement had shown that it didn't have the force to break through the permanent political class. Trump had been the armor-piercing shell that could pierce the Clinton part, but not the rest. The Republican establishment had brought Trump to heel, he believed. The tax cut was a 100% corporate interest tax cut. The budget, adding $1.5 trillion to the deficit, was the worst part of the permanent political class boomtown mentality where every lobbyist got their deal for their clients. There was no wall. The swamp had won. The deep state was not the problem. It was the up-in-your-face state. Most compromising for Trump, in Bannon's view, was the January 26, 2018 speech that Trump gave at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. The New York Times headline had been, "Trump arrived in Davos as a party wrecker. He leaves praised as a pragmatist." It had been a Chamber of Commerce speech, Bannon believed. Trump had looked at the establishment and essentially embraced it. Trump's critique of Attorney General Jeff Sessions was particularly galling to Bannon. He was sure Trump would never get a better guy confirmed by the Senate. Grievance was a big part of Trump's core, very much like a 14-year-old boy who felt he was being picked on unfairly. You couldn't talk to him in adult logic. Teenage logic was necessary. During Trump's first 6 months in the White House, few understood how much media he consumed. It was scary. Trump didn't show up for work until 11 in the morning. Many times, he watched 6 to 8 hours of television in a day. "Think what your brain would be like if you did that," Bannon asked. Bannon claimed he used to say to Trump, "Cut the fucking thing off." At Mar-a-Lago, Trump would come back from playing golf. It'd be a Saturday afternoon in February or March. Absolutely stunningly beautiful. One of the most beautiful things in the world. Melania would be in the room right next door. He would watch CNN's D-team of panelists, whom Bannon considered super haters, and get worked up. Bannon would say, "What are you doing? Why do you do this? Cut this off. It's not meaningful. Just enjoy yourself." Trump's response would often go like this. "You see that? That's a fucking lie. Who the fuck's..." Bannon would say, "Go play some slap and tickle with Melania." Trump also did not spend much time with his son Barron, then age 11. Bannon felt he was not friends with Trump. Trump didn't have genuine friends. He was a throwback to a different time, 1950s America. He was a man's man and a guy's guy. The hashtag Time's Up and hashtag Me Too movements of women and feminists would create an alternative to end the male-dominated patriarchy, Bannon believed. Trump is the perfect foil, he summarized. He's the bad father, the terrible first husband, the boyfriend that fucked you over and wasted all those years and you gave up your youth for and then dumped you, and the terrible boss that grabbed you by the pussy all the time and demeaned you. President Trump's tweets may have come close to starting a war with North Korea in early 2018. The public never learned the full story of the risks that Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un took as they engaged in a public battle of words. It began on New Year's Day in an address by Kim, reminding the world and the American president of his nuclear weapons. "It is not a mere threat, but a reality that I have a nuclear button on the desk in my office," Kim declared. "All of the mainland United States is within the range of our nuclear strike." It was an ugly and provocative threat. Lingering after receiving his president's daily briefing on January 2nd, President Trump said, "In this job, I'm playing five hands of poker simultaneously, and right now, we're winning most of the hands. Iran is busting up, and the regime is under intense pressure. Pakistan is terrified of losing all our security aid and reimbursements. And South Korea is going to capitulate to us on trade and talks with North Korea." He seemed on top of the world, but he didn't mention the fifth poker hand. Real power is fear. The answer on North Korea was to scare Kim Jong-un. "He's a bully," Trump told Porter. "He's a tough guy. The way to deal with those people is by being tough, and I'm going to intimidate him, and I'm going to outfox him." That evening, Trump sent a taunting "Mine is bigger than yours" tweet that shook the White House and the diplomatic community. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un just stated that the nuclear button is on his desk at all times, Trump wrote on Twitter at 7:49 p.m. "Will someone from his depleted and food-starved regime please inform him that I, too, have a nuclear button, but it is a much bigger and more powerful one than his. And my button works." It played on Kim's insecurities. In the last 6 years, 18 of Kim's 86 missile tests had failed, according to the Center for Non-Proliferation Studies. The President of the United States was practicing a scene out of Dr. Strangelove. The Internet lost its collective mind. The Washington Post's Twitter account rushed to clarify, "There is no button." Colin Kahl, Obama's first Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, tweeted, "Folks aren't freaking out about a literal button. They are freaking out about the mental instability of a man who can kill millions without permission from anybody." Many on Twitter wondered if Trump had violated the platform's terms of service by threatening nuclear war. Others recalled Hillary Clinton's line from her July 2016 convention speech, "A man you can bait with a tweet is not a man we can trust with nuclear weapons." Trump's tweet was not without supporters. A writer for the conservative Washington Examiner concluded, "One of former President Barack Obama's central challenges was the foreign perception, by friends and foes alike, that he was reluctant to employ the full range of U.S. power. I believe Trump is right to roll the dice and take the opposite approach." Trump was not done, nor was he satisfied that it sufficed for the United States, the top nuclear power in the world, to issue an unprecedented threat. Within the White House, but not publicly, Trump proposed sending a tweet declaring that he was ordering all U.S. military dependents, thousands of the family members of 28,500 troops, out of South Korea. The act of removing the dependents would almost certainly be read in North Korea as a signal that the United States was seriously preparing for war. On December 4th, McMaster had received a warning at the White House. Ri Su-yong, the vice chairman of the Politburo, had told intermediaries that the North would take the evacuation of U.S. civilians as a sign of imminent attack. Withdrawing dependence was one of the last cards to play. The possible tweets scared the daylights out of the Pentagon leadership, Mattis and Dunford. A declaration of intent to do so from the U.S. commander-in-chief on Twitter was almost unthinkable. A tweet about ordering all military dependents out of South Korea could provoke Kim. The leader of a country like North Korea that only recently had acquired nuclear weapons and had many fewer nukes than a potential adversary could be trigger-happy. A use-it-or-lose-it mindset could take hold. The tweet did not go out. But Trump wouldn't drop the matter and raised the issue of withdrawing U.S. military dependents with Senator Graham. On December 3rd, before Trump and Kim's war of words and after a North Korean ICBM test, Graham had advocated removing military families from South Korea. "It's crazy to send spouses and children to South Korea," he said on CBS's Face the Nation. He suggested making South Korea an unaccompanied tour for service members and said, "I think it's now time to start moving American dependents out of South Korea." Now, a month later, when Trump called, Graham seemed to have had a change of heart. "You need to think long and hard before you make that decision," Graham said, "because when you make that decision, it is hard to go back. The day you do that is the day you rock the South Korean stock market and the Japanese economy. That is a big frigging deal." "You think I should wait?" Trump asked. "Mr. President," Graham said, "I don't think you should ever start this process unless you're ready to go to war." Trump had stayed his Twitter finger for the moment, but the issue of U.S. military dependence in South Korea did not go away. The U.S. military, however, continued to send dependents to South Korea.